I Found a True Love from Buddy Guy, 1961, from his release I Was Walking Through the Woods. All right, Buddy Guy here on the Deep Blues Hour on WRCT, Pittsburgh.
I found a true love indeed. Oh, and it's good to me. I said I found a true love, man, and it's good to me. Yes, and what I'm going to do with it, I want the whole wide world to stop still and they will see. You know the women don't like her, 'cause this little girl, she'll speak her mind. I'll say the women don't like her, because this little girl, she'll speak her mind. You know the women all crazy about her, 'cause my baby, she takes her time.
Hello everybody, welcome to another Temple Sounds show with I, Dr. Kenya, Oscar Raduli. Let us know where you're listening from, we'll big up your wins, 412-499-5000. We're coming back after taking a month break. Christmas was just a good time to take some time off, to be family, friends, companions, enemies, frenemies, you name it. We managed to travel to Europe, Africa, and back to the Americas. We feel so rejuvenated. Can't wait back to get into our radio show, yeah? It's artist's name is Beyond Music, featuring Spots. Song is called Njalo. Welcome.
WRCT in sound from way out.
So it's been months since I did our last sort of comprehensive COVID update about where we are. And sadly, the reason I'm doing such a segment today is that many signs don't look good. And there's every indication that another spike could be coming. Now, there's still the possibility that that's not the case. And I'll talk about what that looks like in a moment. But we will get to that. There is an argument to be made that in general, cases are no longer really the best indicator of the status of the pandemic, that we should be looking at hospitalizations and deaths, et cetera. And I think that there's something to that. But still, cases are a leading indicator of hospitalization and death. The question is just to what degree. Now, none of us want another spike. But unfortunately, it does appear as though one is coming. And there is evidence from other countries suggesting this. And unfortunately, there's also evidence from the United States. And as always, I am always going to report to you the way things are, not the way I wish things would be. So first and foremost, if we look at global cases, what has been a massive decline from nearly 4 million cases a day down well under 2 million cases a day has reversed. Now, this is global. So we got down to a lower point and global cases are now starting to go up. Now, they're not going up in the United States yet, although I will argue that they actually are. And if you look at the right data, that you can see that. But where are we seeing actual recorded case numbers increase? Well, first and foremost, Germany. And they're not only going up a little bit. 2 days ago, Germany had the most new cases in a single day of the entire pandemic. It's exhausting. I know it's exhausting, but about 300,000 cases in a single day in Germany, a pandemic record. You look at Finland. Finland, since about mid-January, has individually seen some higher case days. And if you look now at the 7-day rolling average of new cases in Finland, it is at a pandemic high. If you look at the United Kingdom, massive decline. Remember, at the peak of Omicron, the UK was seeing about 200,000 known cases per day, about 210, 220. That got all the way down below 50K. And now has gone back up by about double. I mean, the UK has almost now doubled daily cases from that bottoming out we saw at the beginning of March. That's really not good, because so far in the pandemic, everything that's happened in the UK has happened in the US a little bit later. And then you look at Iceland, which, I mean, the entire pandemic looks like almost nothing compared to the current 2,500 cases a day that Iceland is seeing, essentially at a pandemic high 7-day average. And lastly, if you look at I actually forget where this is. It doesn't say. I believe that this is. Oh, where is this? This is somewhere in Asia. I was trying to give a perspective globally. I did not even include what country this is. A new high. Wow. I don't remember where that is. We'll get that information. So. OK, cases are going up elsewhere, but they're not going up in the U.S., right? Well, not exactly. In the United States, as I've told you before, wastewater COVID readings can be a leading indicator even earlier than cases about the direction that things are going. And although Dr. Vincent Racaniello, last time he was on with us, said the wastewater data is not an exact science, it is still a generally speaking leading indicator. And there's an article in Bloomberg. U.S. sewer data warns of a new bump in COVID cases after lull. data from wastewater can spot a rise in infections before it shows up in positive tests. And unfortunately, it's not looking good. More than a third of the CDC's wastewater sample sites across the U.S. show rising COVID trends from March 1 to March 10. Even though cases remain at a record low, the number of sites with rising signals of COVID is nearly twice what it was during the February 1 to 10 period. It's not clear how many new infections the signs in the sewage represent and if they will turn into a new wave, or will it be just a brief bump on the way down from the last one? So obviously, we all hope that this is going to be maybe a leveling out in the United States and then we continue down, or maybe a slight uptick. The unfortunate thing is, if we're totally honest and transparent, if you look at what's starting to happen in other countries, it doesn't bode particularly well. Now, everything's wide open, even though you still have people protesting mandates and closures in the United States. There essentially are none. Everything's open. Everything's happening. And quite frankly, I don't know what should be taking place right now. It's been more than 2 years now of this, almost to the day. It's been 2 years and a week or something like that of this at this point in time. The political will to continue having things shut down is almost completely gone. The social motivation to do it is almost completely gone. The infection fatality rate is significantly lower. That doesn't mean that if things get completely out of control in cases, people aren't going to die. They are. And I am not in a position where I am going to say close everything. We now know that close everything is too broad a strategy, and we know that close everything in many cases didn't even really achieve what we wanted it to achieve. But do nothing also doesn't make sense if we see another spike. So we're going to be following the data. We're going to be tracking what happens. Particularly the UK numbers are not looking good, and so far everything that happens in the UK happens here 4 to 6 weeks later. So my expectation is that by April 1st, we are going to see higher cases in the US than we see right now. Why do I think that? Because it's already in the wastewater data. It's already there. There's no way it would be any other way. The question is it just a little bump plateau and then we continue down or not? And I don't know the answer to that. I want to talk a little bit today about incels. Now, this is often mentioned jokingly, but this is really a serious and important thing. It's often mentioned casually. You know, a lot of terrorism, a lot of domestic terrorist acts at their core are the results of incels. Now, you might not know what an incel is. Incel is short for involuntarily celibate, involuntarily celibate, incel. I hope that makes sense. And what it refers to is an incel is someone who would like to be in a sexual relationship, but they are unable to get into one because they either can't find someone to be in such a relationship with, or they're too, you know, shy to try or whatever. So they're celibate, but not voluntarily, involuntarily. Now, whether this is funny or not, it's actually a real source of concern about the radicalizing effect of incel circumstances. And there's a new Secret Service report exactly about this. And I've mentioned this in the past many times. How many of these incidents that we are seeing are a combination of political radicalization and the frustrations of involuntary celibacy? Of course, never saying that anybody who can't find a date is going to go out and commit violence or act of terror. Overwhelmingly, almost none of the people that are involuntarily celibate are going to go out and commit acts of violence. But is it a factor among some of those that do? A very interesting CBS write-up. New Secret Service report details growing incel terrorism threat. The federal government on Tuesday today released a study on the growing terrorism threat from men who call themselves anti-feminists or involuntarily celibates and draw motivation for violence from their inability to develop relationships with women. Almost exclusively, these are heterosexual men who would like a relationship with a woman and are unable to find one. Since 2014, attacks inspired by the incel movement and spanning the U.S. and Canada have left dozens dead. Early intervention and behavioral threat assessments could be the difference between life and death for women targeted by the growing ideology, according to the 26-page report. The report concluded that while, quote, there is no one profile of an individual who plans or executes an act of targeted violence, investigators must consider potential targets when seeking to thwart attacks, as suspects routinely, quote, explore multiple targets during the planning process before making their final decision. The U.S. Secret Service's National Threat Assessment Center took a deep dive into a series of red flags predating a shooting at a yoga studio in Florida to determine how early intervention could have saved lives. In the case of 40-year-old gunman Scott Paul Bayerly, there were countless warning signs. The man who opened fire inside Hot Yoga Tallahassee, killing two women and injuring four before committing suicide, had previously been fired from multiple teaching jobs, barred from bars in apartment buildings, and once authored a 70,000-word revenge fantasy about a boy-turned-serial killer. There is a putting that particular story aside, the whole point here is an analysis of the idea that there are people motivated to carry out violence by their inability to either develop or maintain a relationship with women. Now, the report mentions, and it's important to consider, the origins of anti-feminist and incel movements vary, and they're not always the exact same thing. So there are people who are radicalized into extreme anti-feminist ideology, not necessarily by their personal inability to form a relationship with a woman, but some are. And then along those same lines, not all incels are anti-feminists. Some are just incels and they're fine with feminism, but they just can't develop relationships with women for what may be a number of different reasons. Now, Jordan Peterson has actually talked about this before. Jordan Peterson at one point talked about something called enforced monogamy. And he says that's not literally like you force people. You don't forcibly pair women off with men to prevent them from being incels. But here's what Jordan Peterson had to say about it.
OK, so the question is, what do you mean by enforced monogamy?
Well, we could start by what I don't mean. I don't mean taking innocent women at gunpoint and handing them over to useless men.
That's good. Okay, that's a good thing.
Which is essentially the accusation, you know, and it was really interesting to watch that unfold. What I meant was that monogamy as something that's socially valued appears to be essentially a human universal.
That does not actually seem to be true. I mean, that may well be true in modern society, but historically, that's not really been the case.
It doesn't mean that human beings are universally monogamous, because obviously we're not. We can be serially monogamous, and some people are players and have multiple partners and all of that. But there's a strong proclivity across known societies to tilt towards monogamy. And the enforcement is social norms. It's like, well, think about it. I can't believe that I even have to say this. Your son just gets married and he comes home and he says, guess what, Dad? I've been screwing around. And what do? You pat him on the head and you say, hey, good work, kid. That's my young man. Right? Well, no, you're not happy about that. And he doesn't tell you because he knows you're not going to be happy about it. And that's enforced monogamy.
Okay, so the idea here is basically the way to fight this incel stuff is you have to socially show that monogamy is acceptable and lack of monogamy is not. But it really doesn't actually solve the problem, even if socially not being monogamous is looked down upon. It's still not going to help a lot of these incels. That's just the reality. So it's not clear what we do with this type of information, but it is clear that the incel factor is a real enough factor that the Secret Service threat assessment is, to take a term from the former president, looking at it very strongly. Let me know your thoughts. You can find me on Twitter at D. Pakman. So I want to pick up our conversation about Tulsi Gabbard that we started yesterday. But really, this is now becoming a much bigger story. And one of the things I'm going to show you in a bit is the Ukrainian biolabs people that now are fixated on the Ukrainian biolabs story that's being promulgated by, you know, Tucker Carlson, Glenn Greenwald, Tulsi Gabbard, the usual suspects. These are folks who have sort of their shiny new object instead of COVID anti-vax has shifted to become Ukrainian biolabs. It's the same people. They're just now paying attention to something else. So something really funny has happened. Tulsi Gabbard is now suggesting that Senator Mitt Romney resign. And the idea there is that anybody cares what Tulsi Gabbard thinks about who should resign. That's hilarious. And all of this is centered around Tulsi Gabbard repeating known longtime Russian propaganda talking points about Ukrainian biolabs. So just as a reminder, here's the clip that started it all.
Here are the undeniable facts. There are 25 to 30 U.S. funded biolabs in Ukraine. According to the U.S. government, these biolabs are conducting research on dangerous pathogens. Ukraine is in an active war zone with widespread bombing, artillery, and shelling, and these facilities, even in the best of circumstances, could easily be compromised and release these deadly pathogens. Now, like COVID, these pathogens know no borders. If they are inadvertently or purposely breached or compromised, they will quickly spread all throughout Europe, the United States, and the rest of the world, causing untold suffering and death. So in order to protect the American people, the people of Europe, the people around the world, these labs need to be shut down immediately, and the pathogens that they hold need to be destroyed. Instead of trying to cover this up, the Biden-Harris administration needs to work with Russia, Ukraine, NATO, the UN to immediately implement a ceasefire for all military action in the vicinity of these labs until they're secured and these pathogens are destroyed.
Now, understand that with all of these things, they have kernels of truth. Like, for example, are there laboratories in Ukraine? Yes, there are laboratories in Ukraine that research pathogens and bioweapon defense. They're not developing bioweapons, but they're researching pathogens and bioweapons defense. And also in many other European countries and in other parts of the world. So that's not untrue. Is it true that the U.S., through the DOD, is part of a consortium that is supporting the research being done in a variety of these labs around the world? Yes, that's true, but there's nothing pernicious about it. Would the existence of such a lab in Ukraine in any way justify Russia's invasion? No, of course not. Are these the US's labs to order shut down? No, they're not. And so where this gets into propaganda territory is that some of the kernels that are there aren't untrue in a literal sense, but it's being packaged as a way to provide cover for talking about things other than the completely outrageous Russian invasion of Ukraine. And specifically, this is why this Russian talking point has been a talking point about Ukrainian biolabs for so long. Now, Mitt Romney wasn't having it. Republican Senator Mitt Romney tweeted, "Tulsi Gabbard is parroting false Russian propaganda. Her treasonous lies will may cost lives." Well, we've also since learned that Tulsi didn't like this, and Tulsi started demanding that Mitt Romney resign. And the idea that anybody would care what Tulsi Gabbard thinks at this point is genuinely hilarious. Tulsi doubled down on Twitter, and she said maybe Romney needs to resign, tweeting, quote, "Mitt Romney, you have called me a treasonous liar for stating the fact that there are 25 U.S. funded biolabs in Ukraine, which, if breached, would release and spread deadly pathogens to the U.S. and the world, and therefore must be secured in order to prevent new pandemics." Now, Romney didn't say that she's a traitor because she said that that's what's going on. And it's not clear that there are more than 25 in Ukraine. That's actually a question mark. And they could spread if they were breached, but we don't know that to be true. But she went on to say, "You claim that securing these labs is treasonous." No, he didn't say that securing the labs is treasonous. She said the spread of pathogens is what will cause the loss of life, not the prevention of such spread. And then says, "Senator Romney, please provide evidence that what I said is untrue and treasonous. If you cannot, you should do the honorable thing, apologize and resign from the Senate." Now, of course, Mitt Romney was saying that her parroting of Russian propaganda is what's treasonous. Now, do I think it's literally treasonous? No, it's almost certainly not. And Mitt Romney was using hyperbole. But the idea that Tulsi is going to call for the resignation of Mitt Romney is just hilarious. So the important things to keep in mind about this story, because a week ago, I would have said this is not going to go anywhere. And now this story is everywhere and all the usual suspects have seized on it. The substance of the story itself, we went over in detail yesterday in two segments. I don't want to do it all again since, you know, how many times am I going to do that in 1 week? It's overall a really great example of Russell's teapot. Russell's teapot is this idea that Bertrand Russell came up with, which illustrates the issue of burden of proof. And in particular, burden of proof when people make unfalsifiable claims rather than shifting the burden of disproof to others. And the way Bertrand Russell talked about it was in the context of religion. He wrote, if someone says, OK, there's a teapot orbiting the sun or, you know, orbiting somewhere, orbiting the sun somewhere between Earth and Mars, and it's too small to be seen. You wouldn't expect that anybody would believe that just because they can't disprove that there's this tiny teapot. You can, if he says there's this tiny teapot and it's too small to be seen and too small to be detected, it's very hard to disprove that. But that doesn't mean we just assume that it's true that there is such a teapot. And this entire thing is based on proof. The U.S. is perniciously funding biolabs, bioweapons labs, and there's something dangerous going on or whatever. Well, we don't actually have proof of that. We just have, all we know is there are labs all over the world and they research pathogens and they research how to defend against the bioweapons attack. No. But it's the pernicious nature of these is being covered up. Well, so then how would we know one way or the other? Well, it's up to you to prove that it's not going on. How do you prove something's not going on? We just don't have evidence that it is going on. It's similar to the invisible tiger example I've used before, which is, hey, in my studio right here, there's an invisible tiger. Really? But I can't see it. No, but it's invisible. OK, well, it's invisible, but it still has weight, right? So if we put talcum powder down on the floor, we should be able to see the tiger disturb the talcum powder as it walks around. No, because it's a weightless, invisible tiger. Oh, OK. All right. Well, but I'm sure then that if we open the door and put a little bit of cellophane and then take the oxygen out, the tiger will try to leave the room and we'll see it press up against the cellophane, right? We'll see this. No, because it's an invisible, weightless tiger that has the ability to go through the cellophane. It's endless. It's a bottomless pit. And we need to understand that not only are these claims essentially unfalsifiable to the people making them, these are also much the same people who were doing the anti-vax. They've just found a shiny new object. Here's Ben Collins from NBC explaining this.
Let's talk about, it reminds us of the theories that COVID-19 was deliberately started in a lab and spread out. Does this start and live in those kinds of places?
Yeah, that account on Gab was an anti-vax account. You know, that's the remaining legacy of the anti-vax spaces on the internet. They are conforming to be part of the broader global far right to push these conspiracy theories against the Bidens, against Anthony Fauci, and against what they would call like the medical establishment all throughout the world. The global far right has coalesced around that. And it's worked for Russia too. And in fact, you know, the TASS, the Russian news agency, they didn't post anything about biological weapons attacks that were created in Ukraine in the run-up, in the 1 month before the invasion in Ukraine. But on Thursday and Friday, they posted 24 separate articles about what they call biological weapons in Ukraine.
This is a long time story being that has come out of Russia in the past, and now others are helping to push it. So that starts with Tulsi Gabbard. Next, we'll talk about Madison Cawthorn. So a radical Republican Trumpist Congressman Madison Cawthorn, who knows nothing about history, nothing about foreign policy, nothing about geopolitics, nothing about economics, nothing about mathematics, nothing. OK, you get it. He has been taking the also very friendly to Russia approach of just criticizing Ukraine, but criticizing Ukraine for things which really Russia can be more heavily criticized for, including a lack of democracy and so on and so forth. And this is just beyond parody. Madison Cawthorn did some kind of a public event, and someone in the audience said they wanted to know more about what's really going on in Russia and Ukraine. And hilariously, they want Madison to explain it to them, which is just so funny. Like, why on earth would you go to him? But let's take a look at the clip and see him trot out even more extreme versions of the same talking points.
Yeah. Anybody else?
Yeah, Congressman.
Yes, sir.
We got this mess in the Eastern Europe there with Ukraine and all that. And I know you've made some reference to President Zelensky being a thug or being, you know, and the government being corrupt. We're all trying to figure this thing out. I mean, it seems like we're on the precipice of a possible major disaster. Can you clarify some of that for us so we know where we stand with all of that?
Now, before we even hear the answer, dude, this Madison Cawthorn doesn't know anything. This guy looks like he's, you know, 55, 60, 65. I don't know. How ignorant is he that to find out what's going on with geopolitics, he goes to an event with a clueless congressman and asks him, tell me what's really going on. Okay.
I will. So, one, as I was saying earlier, there's so much propaganda coming out on all sides of this, both from Russia, from Ukraine, from a lot of other countries involved, from our own media, that things are becoming so murky and hard to understand. But
so that's also a really popular talking point they use. It's just so complicated. That UFC guy, Bryce Mitchell, also did it. We don't know what's going on. It's crazy.
Before we all jump to a conclusion, say we're going to go defend a democracy in Eastern Europe, we have to realize that the Ukrainian government is so well known for corruption.
Now, remember, the Russian government is more well known for corruption, and Russia still invaded Ukraine.
It's one of the major sex trafficking hubs of the entire world.
Russia is also a major sex trafficking hub of the world, and it doesn't justify the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
That area. The Ukrainian people are wonderful people. There's a lot of really great people, and those who are patriotically fighting for their freedom, I commend them. They're doing great. But this is not a country that, you know, I feel like is the shining beacon of what really truly is the standard of a good and clean and transparent government.
And Russia is even less a standard of good and clean and transparent government. On any freedom and democracy index, Ukraine ranks far higher than Russia. But either way, Russia invaded Ukraine. So it's not only is he ignoring Russia's record, he's ignoring that none of it would justify an invasion anyway.
And so there was a lot of corruption that's been there. You know, in 2014, there was basically a regime change that happened. You know, there's just a lot of questions and questionable issues going on there. I do plan on releasing in detail in a few weeks, just kind of some ideas and some thoughts that I
imagine waiting around for Madison Cawthorn's report with ideas. Okay, so beyond parody, here's a bonus clip. Madison Cawthorn, in the context of all of this strife, he mentions the Bible, but he doesn't even know what he's talking about when he mentions the Bible.
There would be easy to get disheartened with the things going on, not only in our country, but in our world today. There war is breaking out. You know, in Revelation, it talks about there will be wars and rumors of wars. I think that's exactly what we're seeing.
So, not number one, I don't know what the hell the Bible has to do with any of this, but his references are also incorrect. Wars and rumors of wars is from Mark and from Matthew. I mean, I don't even care about this stuff, but he just happens to be wrong. In Mark 13:5, Jesus said to them, "Watch out that no one deceives you. Many will come in my name claiming I am he and will deceive many. When you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be alarmed." Matthew 24:4, Jesus answered, "Watch out that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name claiming I am the Messiah and will deceive many. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you are not alarmed." Do they even care that the Bible stuff he's quoting isn't accurate? Does anything matter at this point when people are going and asking Madison Cawthorn for his view on geopolitics? My instinct is the facts don't matter. We'll have these clips on our Instagram at David Pakman Show. Today, we're going to be speaking with Thomas Homer Dixon, who's the executive director of the Cascade Institute at Royal Roads University in British Columbia, Canada. His new book is Commanding Hope, The Power We Have to Renew a World in Peril. Some of you may recognize his name because he was also the author of an article we spoke about in January called The American Polity is Cracked and Might Collapse. Canada Must Prepare. It's really great to have you on today. I appreciate your time.
Delighted to be with you, David.
So your article was essentially written as a cautionary message to Canada about, you know, us, the traditionally democratic neighbor to the south, and the possibility that by 2030, the U.S. could become, to use your term, a right wing dictatorship. Can we start by talking about that's only 8 years, a relatively short amount of time. What would be the path for the U.S. to become that over the next 8 years?
In the article, I postulate that Donald Trump is reelected in 2024, and that is really the critical stage in the process that could see the devolution of American democracy into an authoritarian regime of some kind. And people have been beating around in the bushes about this using various terms, autocracy, authoritarian regime. But I just say, look, if we're going to have one person putting himself above the rule of law in the United States, then that is a dictatorship, and we should just call it a dictatorship. So a critical stage would be Donald Trump's reelection. I don't know whether he would actually consolidate a right-wing dictatorship in the United States. It might take a period of time. It might be one of his successors. But I think he would put democracy in the United States in extreme jeopardy. I don't think there's any doubt about that. He would return to office with the goals of vindication and vengeance, really. And he would be unleashed, given that it would probably be his last term in office. And I think that creates enormous concern around the world, not just within the United States. Yes, so this was a warning to Canadian citizens to start preparing for this possibility.
The word dictatorship can mean in practice many different things, and sometimes there's associations with police states, just willy-nilly imprisonment of media or political dissidents, people, as you know, we sometimes say jokingly, although it's not a joke, accidentally stabbing themselves 10 times when they happen to, you know, this type of thing. Which of these characteristics do you think would be plausible in such an American circumstance?
It's a very good question. I lay out a number of pathways in the article. The most benign, I would say, is something resembling, and this wouldn't really qualify as a dictatorship, of course, would something resembling Viktor Orban's illiberal democracy in Hungary.
Yes.
But I think we could go all the way through to something closer to what we see in Russia right now under Vladimir Putin. That seems extreme and seems implausible, I think, for many people, especially on the liberal end of the spectrum. But some of the rhetoric that you're hearing now on the right, against media, for instance, lock them up, shoot them, even from people who are increasingly accepted as part of the mainstream discourse in the United States, it's rhetoric that you would expect from of people who want to impose that kind of brutality within the American polity. So one of the points I make within the article is that a critical development here is the propagation of what scholars call a hardline security doctrine in the United States. And it's been associated with some of the most brutal regimes that have transitioned from democracy. And I use the example of Weimar Germany in the 1920s and 30s, that have transitioned from democracy to a dictatorship. And a critical element of that process has been the propagation of a hardline security doctrine, which suggests for people who adhere to it that there are individuals within the society and groups within the society embedded across the society within civilian sectors of the society that are enemies of the state, who are and enemies of the nation more generally, and who have to be identified and ostracized or even eliminated. And that kind of rhetoric is now becoming much more common on the right in the United States. And that's a precursor of not just a soft authoritarian regime, but it's the kind of thing you would see as a precursor for a much more brutal regime.
In the aftermath of the 2020 election, which Donald Trump, who lost, claimed that he won, we were, I mean, whether we were surprised is a question, but many of us were certainly distraught that more than half of the Republican Party believed it. They at least said that they believed that Joe Biden did not really win that election. Can you talk a little bit about, in this potential dictatorial slide, how important does it matter whether a significant portion of the population buys the lies of the would-be dictator?
Oh, it matters enormously. I mean, it's one of the critical elements here. That is a poison. And again, it's quite similar to that falsehood, the big lie, is quite similar to the falsehood that the Nazis used to reinforce their own legitimacy, the stab in the back, the idea, again, listen to the sort of the rhetoric of the hardline security doctrine, the idea that there was a group, in this particular principally Jews, within Germany who had conspired against Germany during the First World War, at the end of the First World War, and had stabbed Germany in the back and had defeated Germany from within. So the lie that's being propagated now, the falsehood that the election was stolen from Donald Trump, and widely believed and accepted by supposedly somewhere around 70% of Republicans now.
Yeah.
So what are we looking at? 30% of the American electorate, 25 to 30% of the American electorate. You can seize power within a society with a mobilized and coordinated fraction of the society that large, 20 to 30%, absolutely, 100%. Mm-hmm. If everybody else is squabbling and disorganized and not realizing what the nature of the danger is and not reinforcing the institutions of democracy, it's certainly large enough to impose an institutional transition on the society away from democracy. So yes, that falsehood and the fact that it's widely believed, and a substantial proportion of Republicans also believe that violence is justified in returning Trump to the presidency, or would be justified, is, as I say within the article, it's poison within the body politic of the United States, and it's coursing through the entire body politic now.
You mentioned World War II and pre-World War II era Germany. There's been, I mean, for decades at this point, you hear some on the American right and maybe elsewhere say, if the Jews had had guns, the Holocaust wouldn't have happened. Historians have looked at this. It's been widely debunked and explained away. I am curious about what you imagine. I mean, gun culture in the United States is very different than in Canada. And I'm curious what you imagine the potential role of civilian-owned guns to be in an authoritarian takeover of the U.S. And this is with the specific reality that it's definitely more of the folks who believe the big lie that would be likely to have the guns. And this is why, among many of my liberal friends, many are now saying, I'm not a big gun person, but I don't want them to be the only ones with the guns. Give us a sense whether, you know, you have some thoughts as to the role of civilian-owned guns in such a world.
You know, it's enormously important. So in a sense, and you're being very gentle in your description of the situation, by the way. in a sense, what we have is a development of an arms race, a weapons race between different ideological camps in this highly polarized society, and a disintegration of what social scientists call social capital, which is the trust, the bonds of trust and reciprocity that help bind societies together. Societies with high social capital tend to prosper, solve their problems effectively, and those without don't. And we're seeing that. It's a terrible degenerative process. And I think guns are a really important element of that, because they induce a lot of fear, just as you were describing. And the fear causes the retreat to what political scientists call a kind of self-help situation, where you feel you have to take care of yourself. And we all feel that. And now, the irony is that the Second Amendment and the gun culture in the United States is ideologically justified on the right by the fear of a tyrant, right? That we need to maintain our capacity to rebel against an authoritarian state, because that's part of the, it's almost the civic religion of the United States going back to the Revolution, and justifiably in a lot of ways. Of course, the Second Amendment is completely wildly misinterpreted from its original intent. Yes, I would say that the folks who tend to support an authoritarian shift, or would support an authoritarian shift in the United States, who are not supportive of democracy as it currently exists in the United States, will tend to have a disproportionate number of these weapons. 400 million currently, I think, in the civilian population in the United States is just breathtaking. Now, what would happen at, you have all these heavily armed people around, and you have the implementation of an authoritarian regime, which would have elements of a plutocracy, probably, because it would be supported by wealthy, certain elements of wealthy elites in the United States. What's going to happen to all these folks who are heavily armed, who suddenly find that they actually really are living within a dictatorship? That's an interesting question. You might actually find that there's a great deal of opposition from folks who might have otherwise supported or originally supported the shift in the institutions. At this point, where it's complete speculation, we have really no idea where things could go. But it's, again, what I was doing in my article was just opening up these questions, because in Canada, we at least need to start considering them and talking about them.
What do you think the role has been from seeing what's happening in Russia, for example, or in other countries around the world, where, I mean, really, it's these sort of authoritarians that Donald Trump sometimes played coy with and sometimes even expressed admiration for? What sort of effect do you think that has had on the population in the United States?
So this is a really interesting question and a development, and somewhat unexpected. I mean, I've been watching Putin's buildup of arms since last year, and I actually felt that it was quite likely he was going to attack Ukraine. But I hadn't expected, first of all, what we've seen is a democratic rallying around the world, the rallying of democratic countries to come together in the defense of Ukraine. And all of the folks like Viktor Orban and Jared Bolsonaro and Marie Le Pen in France, all of the folks who had cozied up to Putin in various ways, heading for the exits, because all of a sudden they've been substantially delegitimized. I mean, this is a real world lesson in what happens when you get a dictatorship. Dictatorships tend to go to war. Democracies don't go to war with each other. It's one of the strongest empirical laws or generalizations in the social sciences. It's called the democratic peace hypothesis. If you end up with something like Putin or an authoritarian regime, you're much more likely to go to war, because what happens with these folks, and this is part of what's happening in Russia, is as their legitimacy declines internally, because authoritarian regimes tend not to solve their problems very well, they have economic crises and things, as their legitimacy and popularity declines internally, they pick fights with their enemies or with external enemies, and to try to build up, the leaders try to build up their authority and popularity internally by picking fights externally. So we're getting a very vivid lesson in the kind of world we will be creating if we give up on democracy. And I think in an extraordinary way, this is a silver lining from this war. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible situation, but it sort of reminded everyone in the world what's at stake. And I think it actually puts Donald Trump in an interesting way in something of a vulnerable position in the United States as we come into, for instance, the midterms and the presidential election campaign.
That'll be very interesting to see in terms of what impact it has, for sure. We're going to link to Thomas Homer Dixon's article that's been the jumping off point for our conversation today. The new book is Commanding Hope, The Power We Have to Renew a World in Peril. I so appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, this is a story as much about mental illness as it is about anything else, and we're not ridiculing mental illness, we're not stigmatizing it, we're really talking about the sad state of affairs in the United States, where there is so much undiagnosed and untreated mental illness. Our friend Walter Masterson was at the Trump rally in Florence, South Carolina over the weekend. This is the rally we covered live Saturday, and we had clips of Trump's speech from yesterday. And we got a little bit of insight into some of the wackiest characters who were at the rally yesterday. But that was when they were being interviewed by like right wing interviewers who didn't really know the right questions to ask. Walter actually knows what he's doing. So let's get right into this. This is I believe this is a clinically insane hypothesis that this person has. And if they were to sit down with a psychiatrist, I believe they would be medicated for presenting what this person presents in this video. Take a look at this.
I got a good idea what's going on in Ukraine. When they went into Ukraine and they found these labs, they believe that maybe that the deep state is possibly going to use a bioweapon on Russian people. Because they've been, just like they were collecting our DNA in China, they've been collecting their DNA as well.
Okay, so Chinese DNA collection is analogous to something that the deep state is going to do to then bioweapon the Russian population. Wow. I mean, this is someone whose brain is mayonnaise. I don't know any other way to describe it.
So Trump and Putin right now are the only ones successfully fighting against the deep state.
Well, I think as well as Xi, too.
Who?
Xi.
Oh, Xi Jinping?
Mm-hmm.
So Xi Jinping is fighting against he's fighting against it.
No surprise, by the way, that more of these Trumpists just love these dictatorial authoritarians.
Right, because think about it. He's not part of the CCP.
Secretly.
But Xi Jinping, do you think he's working with Putin and Trump against the deep state?
I think he probably is, yeah. Probably. I've heard that.
Yeah.
I mean, I've heard
Xi
that.
Xi Jinping is working against the deep
and
state.
Modi in India. Yeah, I've heard that.
Xi Jinping, Modi, Vladimir Putin, Donald Trump mm-hmm. are all working against the deep state.
Right.
Those they love their dictators, don't they?
And you've got the White Hat Alliance, which is a lot of countries, you know.
I looked, by the way, for the White Hat Alliance. I found no record of it. There's a small hacking group called the White Hat Alliance. It's very clearly not what this woman's referring to.
France.
He is part of the good guys. The reason I think that is because he's fixing to go into Taiwan. You wait and see what I tell you. Mm. When he gets into Taiwan, guess what he's going to find? More labs.
More bio labs.
That is all planned out, y'all. It's all planned. This is one big sting operation. That's what I believe.
Yeah, so Xi Jinping, Putin, and Trump
are
the only ones fighting against the deep state. And making sure that there are no bioweapons to
that's
be released.
That's right.
Because now, hold on.
Because if they do not stop them, they will release them.
Right. If we were to do a skit with some person joking about crazy conspiracy theories, you couldn't do any better than that. Their mind is truly gone, or it was never there, or whatever. Here's another example. And again, we're not joking when we say mental illness, but we're also not saying political extremism is exclusively mental illness. We're not saying that either. This just happens to be the perfect nexus of both. Here's another one.
When it came out, it was Corona, right? Corona. Corona is six letters. When you use gematria.
Okay, now. Gematria is Hebrew numerology, the alphabet, okay, the alphabet, the Hebrew alphabet, the alphabet. It's the idea of assigning, you know, one to the letter Aleph. And okay, so this is Hebrew numerology.
You say A is 1, B is 2, C is 3.
Right.
And you put Corona lined out at 666. So that's 666. But we found that out. So they're saying the white wing crazies found it out. So they changed it to COVID-19, which is C. What is this? C, right?
The C, yeah.
Ovid. Look it up. Ovid means sheep. 19, military code for surrender. C, sheep, surrender. That's no joke.
Wow, that...
So that's from The Good Liars. These are very sick people. And my concerns are two. We should provide access to mental health services. I'm not joking. That is one side of this. The other side of this is you don't correct these views by sitting down with people and chatting for a few minutes. OK, so from an electoral strategy, there's also a question as to what do you do? What do you do? And I don't have the answer, but it's very, very sad what's going on. We are now getting the expert testimony of the not smartest son of the former president, Donald Trump. I'm talking about Eric Trump. Eric Trump went on Fox News's Hannity program to try to defend his dad and attack Joe Biden on the topic of Ukraine. Now, at this point, it sort of seems pointless in the sense that Joe Biden has an almost 60% approval on his handling of Ukraine, which in a country as polarized as the United States, when 60% of the country believes you're doing a good job, that's pretty overwhelming, sadly, in this polarized state of affairs. Trump never had 60% approval on anything that he oversaw while he was president. And they clearly know it. They're trying to run interference for Trump. But remember, Trump withheld military aid to Ukraine, hoping it would force Zelensky to start providing dirt on Joe Biden. Thanks to that little strategy being outed, Trump ultimately had to release the military aid to Ukraine. So anyway, Eric Trump talks to Sean Hannity, and it's all completely crazy. It's a delusional fantasy world understanding of how Trump and foreign policy coexisted. And this is the Trumpian sort of analysis that counts as analysis in their world in which they live.
Listen, my father would, you know, call up and he would have said, Vladimir, don't even think about it. Don't even try us. I'm telling you, it's not going to work out very well for you.
Right. So this is the idea that Trump was really, really tough on Putin and that Putin respected Trump. Now, you can say a lot of things about Putin. I don't think he really cares about the welfare of individual Russians. He cares about, you know, furthering his plans for a sort of new USSR. And that's his priority. Putin's ruthless and brutal. He disappears dissidents. He disappears slash, you know, disappears. And by that, I mean kills and sometimes unjustly imprisons media people who don't agree. You could say all that stuff about Putin, but Putin is way smarter than Trump. There's no doubt about that. And there is no way in hell that Putin was intimidated in any way by Donald Trump. Let's go to the next clip.
By the way, my father had a great relationship with Putin.
We know.
All the while, he's sending thousands of Javelin missiles to the Ukraine. Isn't that really amazing?
By the way, they still are on the Ukraine.
I mean, Biden has no relationship with Putin, and he's literally sending blankets to Ukraine. It's, you know, again, Sean, it's...
So these are, of course, lies. Biden and the U.S. have sent significant military aid to Ukraine. Remember that the aid Eric Trump is referring to his dad sending was aid that Trump initially withheld because he was trying to push Zelensky to announce that they were investigating Joe and Hunter Biden. He ultimately released the aid. But again, importantly, a good relationship with Putin comes when Putin sees that you're a joke, when Putin sees that you're a patsy. And that's exactly what Putin saw in Donald Trump. Here's one last clip of Eric Trump's incisive and principled analysis of geopolitics.
Why? Well, listen, Putin was in with the KGB. He can read people and he could tell that Donald Trump was a very strong person, right?
Right. No, wrong. And again, 90% of that sentence is right. Putin was in the KGB. Putin can read people and he can tell that Donald Trump was a very weak person. I mean, remember Trump coming out in Helsinki and saying, listen, I asked him, did you hack us? Did you hack the U.S.? And he said no, and he said it very strongly, and I believe him. That's what Putin saw in Trump. Trump is a patsy. So nobody ever said Eric was the smart one, but now just obviously, I mean, just laughably unbelievable claims about Trump's handling of geopolitics, foreign relations, Russia, and Ukraine. We have a voicemail number, which is 2192-DAVID-P. Here is a voicemail from the man we know as the most chaotic caller of all time, Billy Harrison. And this caller is a great example of why the United States isn't a better country. OK, let's listen.
David Pakman, Billy Harrison here, calling again. I'm calling on the fact that I'm watching your little live video that you have with Trump. Because I've watched the live video already, but I kind of go back and watch yours because you laugh at it, really, me and my wife. I called a while back and kind of asked you to, me and you debate live, but you refused to do it.
As I've said before, Billy, you can call in when we take live calls. I mean, I'm not going to debate live. I'm not going to fly to wherever you live and debate you in person. If you call in anytime and confront me about whatever.
But you're claiming about the biolabs in Ukraine that someone has to prove it, that there's no evidence of it.
No. See, we talked about this earlier. I'm not claiming anyone has to prove that there's no evidence of it. What I'm explaining is that no one has brought forth any evidence that the labs in Ukraine are in any way unique or pernicious relative to all the other labs that do pathogen research all over Europe and all over the world. And it certainly is no justification for the Russian invasion. That's the issue.
Somebody commented and called you out on that. About Tucker Carlson saying that it was true and they were reporting on it, and you said that it is stupid for someone to basically say, you know, start saying stuff like that without no evidence.
Is anybody else even following this?
But you don't have no evidence that it ain't true.
And of course, this gets us to the exact Russell's teapot principle that I mentioned earlier. People who don't have any understanding of what the burden of proof mechanism is. And I'm not going to go point counterpoint with Billy Harrison, but what I do want to mention is if someone so misunderstands what is even being said, how do we even talk to these people? It's not that we disagree about our analysis. The guy doesn't even have any idea what's been said. He's wrong about what Tucker said. He's wrong about what I said. There's no shared basis of fact. It's a very sad situation in this country. Very, very sad. We've got a great bonus show for you today. Sign up at joinpacman.com to get access.
Oh, the bonus show where you want to make money. Everybody else that makes money to fund themselves.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet, because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
With your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
RCT Pittsburgh,
meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best.
Those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Positions during the negotiations already sound more realistic, but time is still needed for the decisions to be in the interests of Ukraine.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky suggests progress is being made on peace talks to end Russia's brutal three-week-long invasion. This comes as UNICEF says the war is creating a child refugee every second. As more buildings are shelled in Kyiv, we go to the Ukrainian capital for the latest. Then, as Zelensky repeats his call for NATO to impose a no-fly zone, we speak to historian Stephen Wertheim.
If the United States and NATO were to declare a no-fly zone over Ukraine, they would have to shoot Russian planes out of the sky. That's what a no-fly zone means. And that would mean a direct war with nuclear-armed Russia.
And as the world focuses on Ukraine, we look at how the U.S. is expanding its support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen at a time when the Biden administration's moving to pressure the Saudis to pump more oil. We'll speak to Sarah Lee Whitson, head of Democracy for the Arab World Now, or DAWN.
It's so discombobulating to see Secretary Blinken and President Biden falling over themselves to decry Russian atrocities in Ukraine while they support very similar, if not worse, certainly to date worse, atrocities by Saudi Arabia and the UAE.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the Russian invasion of Ukraine is in its 21st day, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Russian demands are becoming more realistic in ongoing negotiations to end the assault. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said he sees some hope for a compromise. Zelensky said Tuesday he doesn't expect Ukraine to join NATO anytime soon. Later today, the Ukrainian leader is virtually addressing the U.S. Congress, where he's expected to repeat calls for more military reinforcement and a no-fly zone. On Tuesday, the prime ministers of Poland, Slovenia, and the Czech Republic held a joint news conference with President Zelensky in Kyiv. This is the Czech Prime Minister.
You are fighting for your lives, for your families, for your country, for freedom. But we know you are fighting also for our lives and for our freedom. We know it. And probably the main goal of our visit or main message of our mission is to say you are not alone. Our countries stand with you. Europe stand with your country.
Ukraine's capital is now under a curfew as Russia continues to bomb residential areas. Earlier today, Russian forces shelled a 12-story apartment building in Kyiv. Ukraine's other cities also remain under attack or Russian occupation. On Tuesday, survivors of a Russian airstrike on a residential block in Kharkiv were evacuated by rescue workers.
Brotherly nation, my mother comes from Borisov. I have relatives in Kursk. How could this monster, oh my God, monster, come up with something like this? To destruct everything. People are starving. There is no water, no wood for heating. And he decided to destroy a city in the 21st century, a beautiful city.
Meanwhile, the humanitarian crisis continues to worsen. Over 3 million people have now become refugees. On Tuesday, President Zelensky said 100 children have been killed since the start of the invasion. UNICEF says a child war refugee is being created every second in Ukraine. Two Fox News journalists, the camera operator Pierre Zarzewski and producer Alexandra Kuvshinova, were killed earlier this week when their vehicle was struck outside Kyiv. Fox News correspondent Benjamin Hall was injured in the attack and hospitalized. Ukrainian officials say he lost part of his leg. At least five media professionals have